Well done, Bev. You deserve that applause and more. I actually gave Bev a pass, and she chose to read that, so thank you, Bev. You spared me from having to read it. I probably wouldn't have got the applause. 20 years of Sunday school paid off. Well done. I'm guessing that that was so edifying for you that I could probably just pronounce the benediction right now, right? But it might have been for Matthew's first hearers, and I have a very good reason for presenting that and having it read and for speaking on it this morning, and we will get to that shortly. It's obvious now that we are going into a series on the book of Matthew, and I like to always start off a new series with some reasons as to why we are in this particular book or why we're focusing on this. For one thing, Matthew has an agenda, and I like his agenda. I think it needs to become our agenda, and that's what we are going to explore in the coming weeks. Matthew has a real focus on discipleship. This is going to be a real emphasis for him. And I think that that is something that, once again, needs to be happening among us here. I need to focus on my own discipleship. We need to focus on discipleship together. I actually spoke on this earlier this summer. Discipleship is simply apprenticeship. It's apprenticeship to Jesus. I'm going to learn from the master. And that is what Matthew is going to focus on. We have, for a long time in our church, been talking about mission. Mission, mission, mission. Living missionally and so on. You've probably gotten sick of it. Nodding? No? Good for you. Okay, you didn't get sick of it. But we have been talking about mission for a reason. God, Jesus, sends people out. He actually wants to accomplish something in the world that goes beyond these four walls. But what we want to focus on in discipleship, once again, is to remember that before Jesus sends people out, he spends a significant amount of time having them formed. And I want to pay very careful attention to how Jesus makes disciples. So I'm going to invite you to help me with that in this series. A second reason why we are going through a very long gospel. This is a big one. I once heard a quote. A pastor said something like, he would often make trips to St. John, not the East Coast, but trips to St. John's Gospel, as though visiting a foreign country. But he would always return home to St. Paul, not Minnesota. St. Paul, the epistles. Pastors tend to focus on epistles for a variety of reasons, but I raise that simply to say that we are addressing an imbalance in our preaching. It's much easier to preach through an epistle than it is to preach Old Testament narrative or New Testament narrative. It's really challenging, so I'm going to need your help, actually. But you often see Gospels being used as illustrations rather than something that we walk through and actually appropriate the author's agenda for ourselves. So help me with this as we go through. I'd like to provide you with some resources, as I like to do at the beginning of a series. So I'm going to put up a number of books on the screen here, and I'm just going to briefly say, for some of you who like to read, this is where you're going to want to start. I mention this book all the time, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. Every time you approach a new genre in the Bible, this is the first place I'm going. So if I'm reading Revelation, well, they got something on Revelation, because that's a different genre. If I'm reading a gospel, this is where I'm going to go first. Old Testament narrative, when we were going through Ezra and Nehemiah, I mentioned this book as well. They help you look for the things that you need to look for when you're walking your way through a different type of genre. So I would encourage you to take a look at that one. I'm going to be using it not just for this series, and I will mention some things from it today, but also when we get to parables, they have a whole chapter on parables. Parables are not illustrations. Parables are doing something very, very different, and it takes a whole chapter for them to unpack it, so we'll get there at some point. Discipleship by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Used to be called Cost of Discipleship among older translations. It's now simply entitled Discipleship. I would encourage you to work your way through that. It's a little bit heady and theological, but Bonhoeffer was a pastor as well as a theologian, and he strongly believed that theology could be lived, and he wrote it that way. So he never just sticks with theology. And he's going to introduce what it means to be a disciple in those first couple of chapters, and then he moves on, and he works his way through the Sermon on the Mount. And so I will be drawing on that, especially as we go through the Sermon on the Mount, but those first couple of chapters are worth their weight in gold. So if you like a little bit of theology with a lot of application to it, it's really good stuff. One book that I forgot to put up there that I'd also like to mention is Philip Yancey's The Jesus I Never Knew. Yancey was someone I didn't want to like because Yancey's popular, right? And sometimes when you go to school and you get a degree, you get a little bit snobbish, right? And I didn't want to like Yancey. Yancey has really good stuff. I would recommend anything Yancey writes. So I was humbled by that. So I've been rebuked, and I would like to share that with you. The Jesus I Never Knew is a brilliant little book. I actually have these books up here, so you can take a look at it later. N.T. Wright has written so much on Jesus, it can be overwhelming. I'm going to be using his Matthew for Everyone. It's a tiny little book, and he'll just take a section of verses, he'll translate them, and then he'll provide a little devotional after it. It's just wonderful. It's amazing. If you buy one book for this series, get that one. That's what I would suggest. And then the other ones that I have listed up there, they start to increase in difficulty. I think most of them will be accessible to most people in this room. As you get to the bottom one, like How God Became King, The Challenge of Jesus. The Challenge of Jesus, I would say, if you're someone like me who's always got a book on the go, and I know a number of you are like this, you've always got a book on the go, I would really recommend The Challenge of Jesus. You'll be able to access it. It's for people who like to read, who like to think, who like history a little bit, but it is written for someone basically at an undergrad level. So if you've got an undergrad, you could easily access that, and I'd highly recommend it. There's lots and lots of good stuff in there. One more resource, though, and it's not a book. It's the other people in this room. The Bible was written to a community of people. It was not written to individuals. Most people, for most of history, could not read this book. They were relying on other people. And God had that in mind when he had it written. And we need to remember that if we are going to read these books properly, if we're going to read Matthew properly, we have to be doing it together. We have actually been designed to be interdependent. So read in community. I would highly emphasize that when we start missional communities, we'll be looking at Matthew in missional communities. It won't be the only thing we do. We won't be doing that every week, but we will be looking at Matthew. And that is where God has designed this book to be read. It's in community. And not simply to be studied in community for its own sake, but then to be lived among people who are going to see different aspects of what Jesus is doing, and they're going to help us live it out. So if some of you read some of these books, if all of us are walking through Matthew together, and then we're doing it in community, we will all be richer for it. I guarantee you. Trust me on this. Give it a shot. Missional community is a way of working, learning, and living it out into the rhythm of our lives. So try it out. Okay, what is a gospel? Let's get to that. I'd like to ask you, what do you think is the difference between a portrait versus a passport photograph? I got a picture of it that I'll show you up here on the screen. I like those movies, by the way. Okay? A passport photograph is just getting at identification. You could pretty much be dead, and they would still take your passport. In fact, if you were dead, they'd probably like your passport picture more, wouldn't they? They'd prop your eyes open and take a picture, because that's what they're hoping for, right? Just when we've got this person lying down on this, you know, that slab with the toe tag and so on, we want to be able to look at their passport and say that this is that person. There's no expression in it at all. A portrait is something very different. A portrait is about evoking something. It's got something to share with us. They're very, very different. They tell you about a person, actually, don't they? A portrait will tell you something about a person. It's going to highlight certain features, an aspect of that person's personality. The result might be something like this that is a little bit mysterious. A little bit, maybe they're trying to show off this person's intelligence or show that they looked a little bit unpredictable or something like that. A passport doesn't do that for you, but a portrait has something to say about an individual. The Gospels are more like portraits. Matthew wants to throw a light on certain aspects of Jesus, and so he's going to weave his story in such a way that he brings out certain aspects of who Jesus is. Now, what is a gospel as a document? Gospels are not new genres. It's simply the new name that we attach to these four. Okay? But the gospels were simply ancient biographies. It was a genre that had already been well accepted in the ancient world, and we still have biographies today. I've gotten into biographies in the last couple of years. I used to not like them at all. People weren't that interesting to me. Suddenly, people are really, really interesting to me. It's amazing. And so I'm working my way. I've worked through so many biographies in the last year or two. And so I'll put up one on the screen. I'm reading it right now. It's a biography of my favorite author, Dostoevsky. And I've read his books over and over and over again. I love them. They're amazing. And Joseph Frank, who wrote this one, he wrote the definitive biography in any language of Dostoevsky. He wrote it in English. It's 5 volumes long. It's 2,500 pages. I am not reading that version. He then wrote this one instead, and this one is 900 pages or something like that. I can't actually lift that because I'm this piddly little guy, so I got it on my e-reader instead. It's great, I can do that. And he condensed it down into 900 pages. It doesn't mean that he left out anything essential to who Dostoevsky is. But the biblical writers are doing the same sort of thing. They're going to be selective about what they tell us about Jesus. They're not telling us everything about Jesus, but what they select is going to be important for us. And you see that in that verse up there from the Gospel of John. John says, I had to pick. You know, I only get so much space. He had to pick what was important for his particular purposes, for his particular portrait of Jesus. And Matthew is doing the same thing. Furthermore, they're not writing simply to tell us that Jesus did stuff, or this is what Jesus was like, or something like that. They are also writing so that we admire who this person is, so that we begin to imitate this person as well. So they have a particular agenda in mind. So what we need to be doing as we are working our way through this gospel is to ask ourselves, why has Matthew included this particular thing that he's covering in this, and why does he include it in this way? And why does he include it this in this way here at this particular point? Because these books look different. Gordon Fee and Douglas Stewart in that book I mentioned, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, say that there are 3 things we need to keep in mind when you're looking at a gospel. They are selective, they have adapted the story to their particular purposes, and they have placed it in a certain context, and they've done all 3 of those things for a reason. So I'm telling you that in order for you, as you are reading, to think very carefully about why does this look like this, and why is it here in this particular spot? Don't just skim as though, I've heard Jesus say this before, I already know the point, because you'll miss the point, because Matthew has a particular reason for including this here in this way. Different writers will actually use the same story or the same saying and use it in different ways, depending on their particular context and their particular agenda. And I'm talking about Matthew versus Luke. So for example, in the temptation narrative, if you've ever compared Matthew's to Luke's, they actually look different. One has reversed the order of the last 2 temptations, and it has to do with each author's particular agenda of what comes after that. We're looking at the genealogy today. Luke also has a genealogy, and they look incredibly different. They go in opposite directions, they include different names, and they have very different purposes. And they are located at different points in the gospel. So we have to ask ourselves, why? Why is this here in this way? Why does it look like this? So let's get to that genealogy. Jesus' family tree. I'd like you to finish the line for me. I'm going to say a couple words. I'd like you to finish the line. In the beginning. Some of you said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And some of you said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. What's John doing there when he writes that? He's referencing something else. Every single person who heard those lines, like you, are thinking back to the creation narrative, the first time they've heard those lines. Well, Matthew is doing the exact same thing in his opening lines. Why don't you look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. Here's the Greek, Biblos Genesios. Every single person reading that is automatically going to do what you just did within the beginning. They're going to go back to Genesis. Biblos Genesios means book, book of Genesis, actually. Also translated book of origins. Matthew is simply signaling to his readers that he's tying Jesus' story in with this bigger story that has come before them. And that's what this genealogy is then going to do. He's then going to go on and describe that Jesus is the son of two people in particular. What does the text say? Son of David? Son of Abraham. Let's start with Abraham. You already know this, so this is just a recap. Abraham was the father of many nations, and his purpose was to be a blessing to the nations or the world. Yes, same thing. That is what Matthew is getting at here in this particular line. Jesus is going to be the quintessential son of Abraham. Everything that was supposed to characterize Abraham being the father of many nations and being a blessing to the nations, Matthew is now evoking here. Abraham has a particular purpose in God's story. He is going to be the one through whom God works among the wider world. He's going to work through one particular people, the Jews. And he's going to come and bring a blessing to the nations. And Matthew is saying that this is the climax of that story right here. Furthermore, he's going to be a blessing to the nations. You might have noticed in the genealogy when it was read that there are four women included in this. Did you notice that? In those first couple of verses. Matthew has gone out of his way to highlight that because women aren't normally included in an ancient genealogy. They can be, but not normally. Matthew has a purpose. In fact, all of these women are not Jews. All of these women are Gentiles. Matthew's going out of his way to point out that this story fits within God's wider purposes for the world, that the Gentiles have already started to be included in the story. And this is our story, right? We're the Gentiles, right? Like, let's not forget that. This is us. God has us in mind when he's writing this. Abraham is going to be a blessing to the nations. He's bringing out this story of what's happening with the Gentiles. God is after the Gentiles. He's after us. But how is Abraham going to be a blessing to the nations? How is that blessing going to come about? Let me give you the Old Testament version of Old Testament hope in a nutshell. Abraham would be a blessing to the nations by giving birth to a son, particularly a kingly son. That king would become the king of the world. That would be the king who would take care of all the people in the world, Jewish people and Gentile alike. That king would administer justice among the nations because at the moment they don't live with justice. All of the nations would then come to Jerusalem. They would pledge loyalty to the one true king and they would follow Yahweh as their one true king. This gets seen, for example, in Psalm 2, Psalm 72. That's just the very tip of the iceberg. That is the Old Testament hope in a nutshell, that Abraham gives birth to a king, that king would be the one who would look after both his people and the wider nations. The nations would come to Jerusalem, they would pledge loyalty to Yahweh, Israel's God, and follow Israel's king. That is the hope. That is the hope that comes about in terms of the exile and after the exile in the restoration. At that time, there would be a new age of shalom. Swords would be beaten into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, and this would only happen when a son of David is on the throne. World history actually turns on a Jewish king. That's the way that God has set up that story. And that's why Jesus is called not just son of David, but son of Abraham, because Matthew wants to point out that this is being fulfilled among them. David was their greatest king. He didn't really seem so at the time in some ways, but as David faded further and further into the past. It's like his reputation grew. Rob has often shared the joke that his dad has been a pastor of a number of different churches, and every time he goes back to visit one of those churches, he comes away saying, the longer I'm gone, the better I was. You know, Rob might even experience that being on sabbatical, I don't know. But anyway, the longer he's gone, the better he is, the better he seemed to them. And that's the same thing that's happening with David in Jewish history. The further and further away that they get from David, the more they wish for another David. And that is what they are waiting for in terms of a Messiah, is another king like David. That king like David, the one that they're hoping for, is the one who's going to put the story back on track. That Old Testament hope, Abraham being a blessing to the nations by providing a king who is going to rule the nations and administer justice and bring about a time of shalom. That is what they're waiting for. And that is the story that Matthew is situating Jesus in with his genealogy here. This genealogy validates Jesus' kingship. It doesn't look edifying or impressive to us because we don't read it with those eyes. We don't hear it with those ears. But every first century good Jewish boy read that and went, hokey toot, I can't believe who Jesus is. Like, Jesus is the one true king. That is what Matthew is getting at. You guys like hokey toot, don't you? It's a Jewish thing, yes. I learned it in Hebrew class. This genealogy is validating Jesus' kingship, which means that Jesus is on a restoration movement. Jesus has some expectations that are coming with him because he is going to be son of David and son of Abraham. He's got the Gentiles in view, but he is going to restore the monarchy. That's what they're waiting for. So Jesus is actually leading both a restoration movement when it comes to the monarchy. He's also leading a revolution because this is a different king than the one that's currently on the throne. And that's why it needs to be kept a secret sometimes in the Gospels, as you'll see. This is a restoration movement among Jews. A restoration movement led by a Messiah. Messiah just means king. Messiah has never, ever, ever in the history of interpretation meant son of God. Or sorry, not son of God, but second person of the Trinity. Messiah means king, always king. Jesus is instituting a new age. The age when he becomes king, messianic age. The age when God will rule through his people, specifically through his one king. Jesus is the climax of this story. The story about an Israelite king and his role among the nations. That's why we have both in the genealogy an emphasis on kingship, and you see it in the epilogue too, right? All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Who is the world's one true king? Jesus. Why is he crucified? What do they put up on the cross? King of the Jews, right? What does Jesus talk most about? Kingdom. Matthew is going to call it kingdom of heaven because it's a way of circumventing the name God. He's talking about the kingdom of God. It's just good Jewish people don't mention the name God, right? Matthew is talking about a restoration movement, a royal restoration movement that has implications for the entire world. So, wrapping up, Jesus is king. And if this isn't what you expected or you wanted, you got to suck it up the way I do, in some ways, right? I would like a Jesus who, you know, kisses little babies and heals a few people and says some nice, wise things and so on. And what I get is someone who's claiming to be king. And we are going to get all of those things when it comes to Jesus, a Jesus who forgives sins, a Jesus who does his healing, and so on. But those are smaller parts of a bigger picture of overall restoration, because the story that started in the Old Testament is going to continue right on into the New. God hasn't actually abandoned his purposes. It's the story of restoration. Matthew is telling this story as with Jesus at the climax. So what on earth does this have to do with my life? You may have been wondering that. I'd like to reverse that. What on earth does this not have to do with my life? If Jesus is king of the entire universe, then that means that absolutely everything has to change. Jesus is literally the pivot of history. Everything else pivots around Jesus. Everything needs to change. So we're going to see that this king is going to be a threat to Herod. He's going to be a threat to Caesar. He's going to be a threat to the ruler of this world. That's all kingdom language. But Jesus is also a threat to my sexuality and your politics and our purpose in life, because it's all about his purposes. If all authority in heaven on earth is about to be given to this king, literally everything changes. Nothing stays the same for my life. Let me draw one other thing. God is at work in this story. And we see God at work over generations. And we see God at work over generations working out his purposes, as you look through that genealogy, with some really, really, at times, wicked people. Start reading some of those stories. Read stories about Tamar and her father-in-law, Judah, and how Tamar becomes pregnant and why. God is not happy about that situation. Go look at the king Manasseh, who's mentioned in this genealogy, who was by far their most wicked king to date, to the point that he sacrifices his own son to foreign gods by torturing him over a barbecue. God incorporates even the sinful decisions that people make into his overall purposes. The choices that you and I make, God can be at work in those. The question is whether or not we are going to get on board with his purposes. But if you are following God and you're doing your best and things don't always go your way and you make mistakes like all of us do, none of our lives are wasted, even those sinful, painful choices. God weaves it all into his story. He doesn't need a blueprint in order to do it. God is actually powerful enough to do it without a plan. He can bring it about. Lastly, let's just remember to let Matthew tell his story in his way. His story, his way. Not the Jesus that I want, but the Jesus I actually get in Matthew. Matthew is selected, he's adapted, he's arranged. So keep that in mind as you're reading. And I do invite us to read together. Let's do that. Let's journey through Matthew together. Let's become better disciples of Jesus together. Let's submit ourselves to this king together. Let's pray. Lord, sometimes we treat Jesus like the pill that will make us feel better and fix whatever problem we have in mind at the moment. And so we read our Gospels, inevitably, selectively. Help us read with Matthew's eyes and his listeners' ears so that we may encounter the portrait of the king that Matthew is presenting. May we find that when we follow this king, everything else changes, because nothing less than world history pivots on King Jesus. May our discipleship to him become the pivot on which our lives turn as well. Amen.